It's a cliche to say that business is global. Of course, everybody understands that. The question is, do they? If you look at it from a boardroom perspective, the answer is yes and no. According to the United Nations Conference on Trade and Development published in 2007, the answer in Europe is clearly yes. When you look at the major European companies, they are seated with people from all across the world. That includes Nestle, Unilever, Fiat. When you look at Japan, the answer is clearly no. It's very Japanese-centric. When you look at the United States, the answer is, by and large, no. In a survey of 589 companies, only 24% of manufacturing firms have non-U.S. people on their boards of directors. And only 14% of financial service firms have board members that are not U.S. Fred's going to be talking about the issue about attracting and retaining non-U.S. people to serve on U.S. boards. He is director of the Human Resource Policy Institute and professor of organization behavior at Boston University School of Management. And I'd like to tell everybody, I took Fred's HR course when he was teaching it at the Harvard Business School. He was 5 years old. I was 3 years old. His governance experience includes, he serves on the board of the Appropriate Technology Corporation, the Cambridge Medical Deploy Situations, the Diagnostic Concepts, and Bright Horizons. He is currently a director of Panera Bread, which is a public company, and is chair of the Compensation Committee. I asked Fred if he could discuss Panera Bread's new venture. And is my understanding of it, instead of the traditional model where you order food from a menu that has prices and then you pay, the new model is you order food that you want and how much you want to pay for it. Fred is founder and director of Human Resources Policy Institute. The institute is a partnership between Boston University School of Management faculty and senior HR executives. Its members include heads of HR for 45 large global companies. Fred received his bachelor's degree from Princeton, his MBA and DBA from Harvard Business School. Again, he was with the Harvard Business School before joining Harvard Boston University. He teaches courses on human resource management, organization behavior, and prior to the teaching world, he was employed with Chrysler. So, Fred.
Okay.
By the way, I'm miking him up, and we have all of our past Feed the Table programs on boardoptions.com and MP3, so you can download.
Well, thank you, and it's great to be here and great to see all of you. I sort of, hopefully you'll view me as a helpful resource, and I really want to kind of raise some issues and questions and then we'll have discussion. In doing the talk, if any of you have a question for kind of clarification, just raise your hand, but there will be plenty of time at the end for question discussion. I guess I would like to begin by saying that I remember Larry extremely well, and it's good to be here, because when I was teaching, initially, the course I taught at Harvard Business School was called Personnel Administration. You remember those days. And I wanted to change it to Strategic Human Resources Management. But I ran into resistance among some of my senior colleagues. So they permitted me to only change it to Personnel Policy Administration. I remember Larry extremely well because at the time, Larry was getting his doctorate at Harvard Graduate School of Education, and very few students from that school walked over the bridge, especially on cold mornings, to come to the Harvard Business School because the schedules were different, the spring vacations were different, but Larry was there. I actually still remember where you sat, and I remember there were just two other students from his school, Holly Aduda and Elizabeth Hawke. I had three students from the School of Education many, many years ago, and I've watched his career flourish in the area, and I've always enjoyed my interactions with him, and I'm glad to know that he's teaching with down at Suffolk now. In terms of the Panera story, your understanding isn't exactly right, but I will clarify the situation. The new thing that Panera has, we've opened the first one last week in St. Louis. There will be one in Boston. There'll be quite a few of them, we hope. It's called Panera Cares. And it's the Panera, it's Ron Shaich, the co-founder, who Paul knows, and the foundation are to help a lot of people who need help these days, and it's sort of his version of the Ronald McDonald House. And we're opening these Panera Cares centers where we have, in cities where we have cafes, and you can pay, the prices will be up on the board, just like they are at a particular cafe, but the feeling is pay whatever you can. And if you cannot pay, then we ask that you would work there for 1 hour. So we'll just sort of see how it goes. The first one opening last week, right after the annual meeting in St. Louis, it's going well. Hopefully there will be a lot of others. So that's the story of Panera Cares. I guess I would like to, and I was prepared to with overheads, PowerPoint, but I was informed that doesn't go here. Informal discussion, but someone once told me that's what power corrupts and PowerPoint corrupts absolutely. So I think so this will be a discussion. I have some notes that I'll refer to, and if you want particular exhibits or anything, I'll be happy to. But I said there will be time for questions and then discussion. I guess the first point is as we all know, and as you're teaching it at Suffolk too, and Larry said, I mean, business more and more is global. I was with the CEO of Colgate-Palmolive in New York last week, Ian Cook, and he talked about Colgate now has 75% of its sales outside the U.S., and that's growing rapidly. And he pointed out that 70% of the world's population lives east of Istanbul, Turkey. Now, when he said east, I didn't know how far he was going, because you go all the way around, you'll get 100%. But I was also recently with some people from Cisco, and Cisco was talking about 70% of the world's population is 5 hours or less from Bangalore. And Cisco is going to run a lot of operations out of that location in India. And IBM is taking one group and running out of Shanghai, and other companies are doing this as well. So there's just a lot of, and if we look at, I'm going to ask you a question. I'm just going to name these companies, and if you can tell me what they have in common, you'll get another prize from Larry, a business card. Chevron, Citigroup, Cardinal Health, Dow Chemical, Pepsi, Alcoa, Northrop Grumman, Hartford Financial Services, News Corporation, Coke, Liberty Mutual, 3M, Colgate, Altria Group. What do they all have in common? Non-U.S. CEO. Non-U.S. here. So before we put sort of boards, and what I'm going to talk about is boards, because what I've been doing on this project, we got the data that Larry was sort of talking about, is looking at U.S. companies and how many have one or more directors who are non-American, and talking to those individuals, like why they joined and what's the strength and weakness of the benefits of it, and talking to the companies about was it a good thing you did and sort of how did you do it. But so there's the board level. There's also the management issue. And as I said, all these companies are headed by a non-American. It's Citigroup, some of India, Cardinal Health Canada, Dow Chemical Australia, Pepsi India, Alcoa Morocco, Hartford Financial Services India, Coke Northern Ireland, 3M Britain, Colgate Britain. So anyway, the changes are sort of within management, and we'll sort of talk about that, because I think, you know, we would all like to think that in these global companies, sort of talent flows to opportunity, regardless of passport. But for a lot of reasons, it doesn't work that way. And so how can it work away? Now, what I've said about American companies is also true for European companies. The following companies, I'll ask the same question. What do you say is in common about all these companies? Unilever, Nestle, Carrefour, L'Oreal, and the Gucci Group. Those companies are all run, but the CEO is not from the country where the company is headquartered. At Unilever, he's French. Nestle is Belgium. Carrefour is Spanish. L'Oreal is Welsh, from Wales. And the Gucci Group is a man who's Dutch. And if we go, just take this a little further, of non-native CEOs in Europe, today in England, 34 of the 100 companies in the FTSE, their 100 index, 34 of the 100 are not Brits. The 34 includes 15 Americans, 3 French, 1 Swede, 1 Spanish, 1 Indian, 1 from Russia. In France, 7 of the 40 companies in their CAC 40 index are non-French. Compares with just 1 in 1998. Even Germany, of the DAX index, 5 of the 30 run by people who are not German. And if we take it a little further, then sort of the individual, then the sort of what's the composition of the top management team? From my visits and moving around, I frequently ask the question of the top 100 in a company, how many passports are represented? If we sort of ask people to put their passports on the table. And from my experience, the most global company I'm familiar with is Nestle. They've got about 30 different passports. But a lot of companies, it's still two American, two German, two Japanese. There's the story about a number of years ago, Eastman Kodak was reorganizing their business, and they came up with 20 global business units. And at the time, 19 of the 20 general managers had spent their entire careers in Rochester, New York, and all have to run a global business from Rochester. And half the group at the time didn't have passports. They hadn't traveled. So you can see why global, as Kodak has continued to decline. I sort of like the story around here. I think Iron Mountain is a great company, great future. Warren Buffett thinks the same thing. And the CEO of Iron Mountain says, we use the term all the time, blink, blink, blink. Blink means be like IBM, not Kodak. And that's in terms of things he thinks because IBM made the transformation and Kodak didn't. And how you and Iron Mountain is getting more and more global. If we look at top management teams, in Nestle, the EVP of France is a Canadian born in Ghana. The EVP of operations is Spanish. The EVP, a zone manager for a big part of the company, he's Dutch. Procter & Gamble, the president of Braun, is Spanish. The president of Global Prestige Products is German, and it goes on and on. A.G. Lafley, P&G, talked about a real priority was developing non-Americans for senior positions. I mean, like Larry, A.G. Lafley, when he was a student at Harvard Business School, took my personnel administration course. Very unusual. Didn't get that big enrollment because, you know, he had a spectacular successful career. He was straight P&G. And he, now chairman of the board of trustees of his undergraduate school, Hamilton College. But he talked about it as a real priority. And so look at his career, you know, working in Japan, working in Europe. But the real priority of developing people, talent from South America, from Asia, for top positions. If we look at sort of the characteristics or the backgrounds of the sort of top teams at Unilever, is a six-member executive board, one French, two Indian, one South African, two Americans. Carrefour, their five-member executive board, includes three Spaniards. And the recently, not that recent now, the came from GE, the person who's trying to get Siemens straightened out and all the ethical issues and challenges, Peter Loescher, he taught in characterizing Siemens as a company. What did he say? He said, it's too German, it's too white, and it's too male. He talks about, said, the management board are all white males. Our 600 top managers are predominantly white German males. We are too one-dimensional. It's not a question of quotas. But I would like to see a much more diverse board. I would like to see a big Chinese running China and a big Indian running India. Diversity is absolutely critical. If you're not representing your global customer base, then you won't tap your full potential. If you're doing it well, you'll have a massive advantage. And they've installed the mentor system. He personally mentors 10 young executives. He's in charge of 4 Germans, 2 Chinese, 1 South African, 1 from Pakistan, 1 American, and 1 from Brazil. So there's the question of sort of what's going on with management and really, you know, who leads? Do you do make some changes at the top, or do you sort of go from management or sort of go back and forth? As I guess, in terms of thinking about globalization of boards, which I want to talk about. And this is what I said. I've sort of looked at the numbers. I've talked to a number of these non-Americans who are on U.S. boards. I've talked to some Americans who are on Japanese or British boards. And I've talked to some companies about their perception of sort of the first non-American on their board. Foreign nationals, and again here we're talking about, and some of you have different interests. Here I'm talking pretty large companies, and that's the sort of universe we're sort of talking about, but it's sort of moving down. Who are the companies that have foreign nationals or direct of U.S. companies? Abbott, Labs, Pharmaceutical Industries does this quite well, a physician from Britain. Bristol Myers Squibb, the president of, former president of Volvo. A man from Brazil, the CEO of Alcoa. He's a director of Citigroup and IBM. A Swede who's on the Coke board. A man, Swede and an Indian, both on the Goldman Sachs board. An Indian who's on the Google board, and it goes on and on. Harman International, someone from China. IBM, someone from Japan. Someone from Mexico. Kraft Foods from Belgium, MasterCard, China, Philip Morris, Mexico, Sara Lee, Netherlands, and it goes on. Textron, two, one from Canada, one from Britain. United Technologies, one from France. Visa, one from Mexico, one from China, and one from Chile. Xerox, one from Germany. It goes on. Similarly, I think I could sort of say, as we've seen the financial crisis the last year or two, and so many companies in big trouble, in some of these cases, when the going gets tough, the tough get going, they quit. Ford lost two directors because it was just too difficult in terms of the meetings and the travel when you have a crisis. General Motors lost their non-American director. Now, in terms of the other thing, the globalization of boards, I mean, Larry's point, if you go to Japanese companies, they don't have. There's one or two exceptions. There's an American who's the director, who's a director of Sony. My boss, who's retiring, and the successor might be named in the next week or two, former president of Ford Europe, who's been a great dean for our school for 19 years, he went on the board of a Japanese company, Sanyo. And I often wonder exactly why he did that, because I don't know if you know about Japanese boards. Unlike American boards, they meet once a month. They meet for 4 hours, and the meetings are in Japanese. Well, he's pretty far away from Japan. He doesn't speak Japanese, so he got their permission that he could attend every other meeting, and they had an interpreter next to him at all the things, and he did this for several years. So either they paid him a lot of money, or he thought he was going to get a big gift for the school, or he just wanted to get away. I don't know, but he's upset. It was 72 hours, I mean, he's a very energetic, it was 72 hours out of his schedule all the time to sort of go there and get back, and that's what he was on that board. There are a few other examples of that. I was thinking of this particular group. I was sort of thinking about, well, what we can say about the larger companies in the Boston area. And Genzyme has some Chinese raised in Hong Kong. Millipore, some from Sweden. Cabot, some from India. Staples from Britain. Staples from India. And State Street Bank, which I'll talk to a little more about. But I would sort of think in this area, if it's true as I understand, TJX is going to be expanding rapidly in Europe, and that's a big growth for them, England, France, and elsewhere. They would probably benefit by having such a person on their board. EMC is another company. Their sort of the global footprint is pretty clear. So I guess the question I sort of, again, raise questions with, is to think about is this a good thing? Does it help a company be competitive around the world if the board has some experience that's different from most directors? And then we get to the sort of the interesting question, if you sort of buy the logic of that, how do you pull it off? Because I think the challenge, and those of you who are in executive search can add to this, and because most times, even though it's certainly changing with governance, et cetera, you know, most times a lot of new board members are sort of personal contacts, friends of friends, on another board together, whatever, and I've seen it on three or four boards that I've been on in terms of who the new people, how they really get on, that really goes on. In this particular case, for the most part, that method doesn't work because the CEO of the company doesn't know CEOs in Europe. He doesn't know anyone in Mexico, and if he does, that person necessarily wouldn't want to be a director. So you frequently have to use search firms. And some search firms, there's two or three that do a lot of it, and I think are quite good in this particular area. Although I must admit that of all the non-Americans that I interviewed who are on the board of an American company like IBM, Exxon, others, not one of them got on that board through a search firm. It was all through personal contact or whatever. Although all of them told me they had been contacted by search firms about being on other boards, and they declined. Because that's the difficult thing. You sort of find the right person, but then the person is taken. Because if you're running some organization, you have time for one board, maybe. Possibly two, but certainly not more than that. So they're kind of taken. So how do you find the people who were good? And then the other question, which we'll get to, is, you know, what are the motivations? Why do people do this? If you have to travel across the Atlantic 6 or 7 times a year, and how do you accommodate this? Now, in terms of the sources that I have seen, there are some companies, I know Boston Scientific has this not, but some companies do have advisory boards, which is no liability, and Textron has its advisory board for Europe. They have another one. Some companies, and some of the companies I've talked to, and people are willing to be on an advisory board, you know, you get treated nice, 2 or 3 day meeting once a year in Europe. That has been a source of talent for some companies. You find someone who's really interested, really qualified, might be interested. That has been a way to, I was on an advisory board at Bright Horizons, and that's how I went from the advisory board to the main board. I guess being well-behaved on the advisory board. So that is, but I said the other thing is sort of what, you know, what's the motivation, and how do you come to the view that we need to do this, because it's difficult to pull out. One example I will share with you in our own area, I'll talk publicly about it, but I think I've heard it discussed at meetings, State Street Bank. A well-known consultant in our area went to the then chairman, Ron Logue, who's, I guess he's still chairman, but he's not the CEO, and had studied the firm and said, you know, as I read what you're doing, all the growth is in Asia and Europe, you're already 40% of your revenues, you say, outside the U.S., and you're growing rapidly, and I look at your board, everyone on your board is from Massachusetts. In addition, they're all within Route 128. What kind of diversity is this for a global company? Pretty good question. And Logue and others like said, this is pretty wonderful. That search consultant got 3 searches, and they brought on 3 Europeans within 6 months. And talking to Ron and other people, they think they made great contributions from their first and second meeting. And it's not only, if you talk to these companies, it's not only kind of the contributions of the meeting. The most important thing is actually their ability to help you in different markets with introductions, contacts, opening up things like, I know so-and-so in Hong Kong. They can be helpful to you if you call them. So I think that is the particular one. They get sort of interest and passion. Now, none of the individuals that I talk to, because what would you say, would said that money had anything to do with them accepting the job. Why do they accept it? Well, one guy told me in England, said, you know, well, to be on the Exxon board, that's my window on the world. To go to Houston this time of year, I mean, I learned so much. I developed so much. Another person told me, he's very honest, he's from France. He said, well, to be honest with you, we have an American son-in-law. And my wife loves the opportunity to come to New York. Another person, I think this is a search firm, is really clever, helping there was an IBM executive, non-American, who was president of IBM Canada. Another company, that was a wonderful developmental experience for him. He was in Canada, he wasn't very far away. He joined, it was the Air Products board. So you have to be really strategic in how you sort of pull this off. But I said, State Street got the retired head of Lehman Brothers Germany, a former vice chair and CEO of Morgan Stanley International, and chair of the Eurasia Group. The other thing in terms of The question I would also give you is, you know, if this is going to work, I mean, a lot of people I talk to, it's almost like when companies had the first minority on the board, the first woman, you talk to some of these people and they're really much more comfortable if there's two. And this one guy was telling me, he said, you know, God, a meeting came up about an investment in Indonesia. And someone to me said, God, has anyone ever been there? Why do you want to do that? I'm like, he had three plants there, knew it quite well. He said, like, I'm frequently the voice. They're not really listened to. But if he felt like if he had a second or third person who was global, he said, these Americans are, they're just, they say they're global, but they're not global. Well, so I think you have to be very strategic in consulting and figuring out who can help you get the right kind of person, who is the right kind of person, because if it's the person who doesn't attend the meetings or doesn't say anything or isn't helpful, it's a costly error. And I guess the other thing I would say is sort of changes that come have to be made to sort of be effective. Now, some of the changes that I'm aware of in some companies, companies have agreed to hold at least one board meeting outside the U.S. So if you say something in London, you know, at least one of the meetings a year will be in England or in France. Some people have made that change. Some other people have made changes in the times of meetings, figuring out when the person is going to get the last plane out of Kennedy or whatever, make sure the meeting ends in time so we can get that particular plane, and when you start meetings and whatever, recognizing that particular thing. One person, one bank that I know, actually changed the compensation policy. For a non-American, you know, if you have to go 3 miles to a meeting, it's different from going 5,000 miles, and they actually pay more to the executive who is from Europe. I think IBM has made a brilliant move. Most companies, you know, have a retirement age of 70, 72. Some companies like TJX, others are moving it up. IBM brought in the former president of the Tokyo Stock Exchange, age 74. Their retirement policy used to be 72. Well, if you got to get someone from Japan, who is available to come that distance, whatever? Someone who's recently retired, President of Stokes Island, and they person told me they hope to get three or four good years out of them. And I guess the other thing, there's some other sort of changes. Now, I guess from the point of view of why people sort of do this, I mentioned some people, it's like it's their sort of development, it's prestige. But I know in one particular company, a drug company, the CEO, and thinking about his own eventual retirement, there were two possible successors. And he felt that what would develop each of them best would be a board experience. One was American, one was not non-American. And he went to a search firm that they'd given a lot of business to, and he said, this is what I want you to do, if you can. Put these two individuals on good boards. I wanted to have that experience. Because you talk to both the president of Colgate-Palmolive said last week, he said, the hardest part of the CEO job is two parts are really hard of it. One is the board. That's a whole new experience. So if you can get on a board, the development experience, and as you think about our own careers, I mean, a nonprofit board can be highly developed. Larry mentioned what you might, it was very innovative. But I know one large consumer products company that they've hired a good search firm to get their high potential people on nonprofit boards, because they think it's a very good developmental experience, and if it works, a big contribution from the company comes to that nonprofit, so the nonprofit wants it, and so it seems to be a win-win situation. So I think for some individuals, it's a very good developmental experience. Now, this particular drug company, one of those people did become the CEO, but he stayed on that other board. So I guess I would sort of raise these questions about, A, you know, is this sort of, is this a positive development? Does this trend sort of continue? The pros and cons of it. If you got to do it, how do you do it? What is sort of the best way of doing it? Because more and more, I mean, some boards, like GE, has said to their executives, at least under the present time, Jeff might change it, they're not allowed to accept any board positions. Just you work for GE full time. No one, even the chairman. Other companies are taking the view. Well, for some people, it could be a good development experience. You could be on one board if it's not doesn't compete, if it's not going to take too much time, and whatever. So I think the other thing that is the companies who are really smart is to look at that individual who's a year or two within retirement, maybe who's retiring early. They still know exactly what's going on. They're in the game, and they're going to have the time and go to like the McKinsey partners. If you're stepping down as vice chairman of Pfizer or Bristol Myers Squibb, whatever, if you've got to look forward to two or three boards to go on, and they'll give permission while you're only 6 months from retirement, we'll give you, you can go on more than one, then that's going to be a good thing. It helps the organization that gets the person if they have the background, knowledge, and experience that that's you need. So I guess I'll just raise that as so opening remarks. I can talk more about specifics if you want to, but I just would like your questions, reactions, comments from where you sit, from different organizations and people who are providing. Yes?
You mentioned earlier you want to talk about State Street.
Well, I guess my State Street example was here we had this company saying it was quite global,
right,
all their literature, and suddenly they got three non-American directors, literally, they put them all on the board at the same time. And it all grew out of this search guy who many of you know, who really put it to them, really challenged them. I mean, he generated work for himself. But I talked to Ron Logue about it. He said it's been much better than he expected in terms of they were contributing at the early meetings and helping State Street. So that's my State Street example. So.
It seemed like most of the companies you were talking about were Fortune 50 companies.
Yes.
But well, is it Fortune 100, but huge companies? What about as it relates down to the companies that are more in, perhaps the people around this table strike zone?
Yeah, that's what I sort of said. This applies more to the larger organization. I mean, because Analog Devices has had someone from Taiwan on its board for many years. But you can go beyond the Fortune 50 and the Fortune 100 within the Fortune 500. But if you sort of look at starting at the Fortune 25 and going down, now, the percent of, Larry gave the overall numbers, but if you break out numbers by size of company, it's much higher in the larger companies. Now, if you're a mid-cap company, a mid-market company, I don't know. Some companies, like if you're a Cayman Savings Bank, I don't think needs any non-American perspective on its board. We at Panera Bread, well, we're slowly entering Canada. We're not global at the present time. I don't think we necessarily need it right now. Bright Horizons, I mean, we had one board member who kept, Bright Horizons, you don't know, there was a leader in on-site corporate child care, had a market cap over $1 billion, and we're running over 600 child care centers. And we had one board member, a very global guy, who kept pushing us, like, you got to step out, what's the next, this and that. Kept pushing the matters, really very constructive, and suddenly we're in Bright Horizons in Ireland, Scotland, England, Guam, a few other places, and that person helped to make some of those things happen. So it depends very much, I think, on the business and the size of the business. But if you're like a company with 100 million, 200 million, it's something that's very far apart. And unless you're just lucky in the sense of you feel, the market is such that to grow this business the way we want it, we got to have a presence in India, we have to do this and that. Well, then if you can, find someone around, either in your management team, Excel, whatever, who has the relevant experience. I mean, the other is, if you find the people who are very knowledgeable in certain parts of the world, but they're here in the U.S., it's a lot easier. I mean, I would bet that this Indian, who last month was named as the first dean of Harvard Business School, first non-American dean, I mean, I'll bet you if he wants, he'll be on five boards for the next 2 years. If he's smart, he'll join one and do it slowly. He'll really establish himself. But he'd be a great person, and certainly some of the consultants that there's a fellow Indian from Bain who's on the Staples board, and Staples is growing a lot internationally. I'm sure that's expertise. But I said, be honest with you, it is the big companies. It's the IBMs, the Pfizer, the Bristol Myers Squibbs, yeah.
I got sort of a, not quite how to phrase this, so I'll just make a few remarks and then ask the question.
That's fine.
It seems to me that the environment of governance is changing a lot recently because of SOX and other kinds of new things coming to the pipe. We'll look at attention to point one. Point two, global companies have already got, for the most part, an enormous diversity of, enormous number of dimensions along which you could segment them. Geographic, product line, technology, et cetera, et cetera. So, to have somebody who would be knowledgeable about all of these things as an expertise is a big task. Thirdly, we acknowledge and for the most part look for diversity ethnically, gender, race, religion, those sorts of things on boards as well. That just adds another whole overlay of dimensions. Okay, so we got a complex machine that is supposed to be directed by a bunch of experts, and I think I've just described the reason why you cannot get a sort of a total solution for any large company. But the fourth thing I wanted to say is that if you start adding people, you know, to meet all of these various needs, you're going to get a board that's too big to function properly. Because as we, our research says, and I'm sure you know more about it than I do, that there's a sort of a magic size beyond which things get...
9 to 11 is the right number.
Exactly, and I've been on bigger boards and smaller boards, and I've seen... So I guess the question, it goes back to your comment, which was sort of a side one, about the use of advisory boards. And would you expect, given what I've just said, that the functioning of the sort of value that companies can get from outside senior advisors would be more concentrated than hitherto in the advisory board area as opposed to the statutory board? And if so, should we see some major growth in that area?
I would actually think so, but there's been always sort of the few companies that have advisory boards. American Express does, Textron does, a few others. And I think they help you in particular in certain parts of the world, the market, the European Advisory Board, the South MENA region advisory board, whatever. But it doesn't seem to grow. I mean, they're sort of hard to establish, I guess, and it takes time, but I would think that they can certainly add a lot. The other point is you can't find the director that's going to, you know, add all these things. But again, you want people to be able to identify with the company and the shareholders, but you want diversity on the board. So you want someone who knows a lot about government relations. You want some person who knows about this or that, because there's a lot of things you have to do. I mean, one of the hottest areas that I could have spoken on, I have another list. I have a list now of over 100 heads of HR that have gone on boards. Well, why are they suddenly popular? Because boards are worried about executive compensation. They're worried about succession planning. Who knows about that? Heads of HR. Now, Bill Connerty, when he was Senior Vice President of HR at GE, a very competent, great guy at GE, he wasn't allowed to go on any board. But he's a generalist, he's well-established, knows a lot, great person. As soon as he announced his retirement, he had 5 board invitations. So far, he's only taken 2. The Cole Peterson, retired head of HR at Walmart, presently on 3 boards, because people recognize that, you know, that talent can be useful. Now, I think your first point is also important, which I did mention, is there needs to be, I put a lot of in sort of recruiting, how you pull it off. There's also a big need for sort of orientation and training. Because if you talk to some of these people, they talk about the frustrations of a new director of an American company, and they say, you know, your accounting is different, this is different, the way you do committees, we do a committee of the whole, you do committees in a different way, whatever. They need a lot of orientation and training. And sort of you think about, you know, who's responsible for that? The head of legal, the head of HR, because, you know, I'm supposed to give orientation to someone who's the CEO of some big company in London. But he needs some help. And someone has to say, this is the way we do things. We need to visit plants or whatever. But I think, I agree with you that advisory councils can be a good thing. They don't seem to be growing. I don't know why. But the other thing is, I think what you're hearing is so many of the venture people are saying, even to real small companies, well, what's your India strategy? Well, we don't have one. Well, then I guess you're not doing it. So you need people with that knowledge and expertise And I mean, a few years ago, I sort of kept watching all these heads of HR that I know making their first, second, third trip to India, as that's become such a big market, and so many employees of IBM and Dell and Accenture and company after company, HP, and you sort of got to have that understanding at the top. Now, there are a lot of Indians who are in good positions in U.S. companies who could be helpful to be on your board. So I think you're making some very good points. Yes, Albert.
I
didn't know if I should include you or not, because one of your directors is born in Germany, who's a professor at Princeton, but I don't know how to count him out. He knows a lot about healthcare, certainly, but
yeah,
go ahead.
But, you know, I mean, a lot of our people on our board, they've also said you've got connections.
Yeah.
What I'm hearing, though, so I'm not talking about Boston Scientific. I'm talking about your point so far, I heard. So I'm going to push your point a little bit.
Good.
I heard that, you know, really what get people onto boards, a lot of times are connections. Certainly my personal experiences, both inside the company and the company I've worked for before and the board that I'm on, they came from connections. They also came from a little bit of specialty skills. I happen to be in the HR area, and I have quite a bit in succession planning leadership, and it played out really well. And why I joined the board was because I know I can do something. Where most of the time in company, I'm subject to the whims of other people. When I'm on the board, I can directly influence, and it really worked nicely that I can actually see the skill that actually being applied. So I do see nowadays when you get people on board, specialty skills are very much needed, mostly for mitigation of risks. So, you know, that goes. But no one ever really started with diversity as a point of view, at least that I'm familiar with. So I'm pushing a point there. So, you know, because your topic is a great deal of interest about how you attract or about how do you retain, right? How do you, get them to be fully functioning on the board? So I haven't heard enough about your ideas about, I'd like to have you speak more, because so far, I think connection, very natural, right? Specialty skill, very natural. Markets and experiences, very natural. Because when I was in China, I was had a big chat for HP in China. It was during the period of time 1988 to 1996. A lot of American companies came to China to investigate. And if you can tell which company that have forethought and know what they are looking for and which are the company completely clueless and don't know what question to ask. So you can push the point sorry, a little longer to make my case. So what's your ideas about really attracting, nurturing, onboarding that create more diversity? Where, in essence, these sources of talent is still connections and very specialty skills due to those connections?
Well, I mean, you're making a lot of good points, and I agree. But I think there are, the normal methods don't work so well if you're going to bring in international global expertise. So that's why Egon Zehnder, Spencer Stewart, they're getting a lot of searches. Now you got to be real careful, because if you're the CEO of some company, you know, take the call. We can't say we're going to introduce five candidates, because like if we're going to introduce you, we better make sure they're going to accept you in advance. Like how they do these searches, they're really hard to do. So I do think search firms seem to have a much bigger role in getting non-American directors than they do get American directors. Now, if a person knows someone through an advisory board, I asked one guy, I said, how did you get to be the director of this particular company? And he said, at Harvard Business School, the current CEO was my roommate. So that was that relationship. That's how, you know. So as I said, of the non-American directors that I talk to, who come to the U.S. six, seven times a year, I didn't find one of them who actually come on through a search firm. But everyone tells me, and people say Spencer Stewart has about 60% of the market, they are used more and more to get. Now, at State Street, Egon Zehnder, it was their search. They brought three individuals on. I think in your other point about, you know, HR, I mean, I wrote an article for Harvard Business Review. I said someday HR people are going to be, you know, real strategic advisors in their companies and attractive as board members of other companies. The then head of Harvard Business Review wanted me to take that out of the article. He said, that has no credibility at all. There's not one HR head I know who could ever be director of a major company. That has to come out. So we modified it, whatever. But that's sort of, but one of the things I've seen, and there's a lot of HR people who want to be on boards, who would be very good on the boards. One source of resistance is the HR head in the particular company. They don't really want someone. You know, for the head of HR, I saw this when Eli Lilly wanted to bring in the head of HR. I'm talking really off the record here. We got to edit this tape. A large drug company in Indiana wanted to bring in the head of HR from a major high-tech hardware company, and there's the HR person in the drug company that did me say, well, gosh.
I'd like to make that same joy and enthusiasm also manifests itself when the general counsel finds out there's a candidate for a board who is a lawyer.
Yeah. Well, I suppose when the CFO supplies that we're going to bring the CFO in from another company because we want him to be the chair of the audit committee. So it's that. So I guess the first point I would say, it is changing somewhat, and search firms have a greater role. But, you know, at the end of the day, the chairman, the board has to feel comfortable with this new person. So you can feel a lot more comfortable with the person if you got to know them because they've been on the advisory council for 3 years. They're not taking such a big risk. Sorry.
I've done some work for mid-cap companies. And it's anecdotal, but it's fairly dramatic. This was a semiconductor company that was manufacturing facilities in the Boston area and mostly the U.S. market. Then they decided to fabricate in China. And then they brought in a Chinese person onto the board. Now it turns out that in China, as you know, who you know is far more critical an issue.
I call it guanxi, right? Relationships.
Your relationships and your family. It's an order of magnitude that we in the United States don't comprehend. And this person did have the connections. And today, that company fabricates in China and most of their customers in China, and they symbolically still have a corporate presence in the United States, but their business is in China. So that one board member basically took their business into China. And I think where the search people come in is to be able to so delicately ask those relationship questions that can be insulting if it's asked by a board member.
Yeah, the point is we can talk of how boards and how companies are trying to sort of take steps to make the board more global. And you do have, for example, Colgate-Palmolive, their board meeting next fall is in Brazil. And sort of to get all of outside directors to, because if you figure out travel and everything, it's like about a week out of your schedule. And this poor guy who I talked to who's arranging the meeting, he's already been to Brazil 3 weeks. He's got another trip throughout security and how all the things is going to work. Warren Buffett is taking the Berkshire board to India next March. And he sort of said, well, he thinks China is much better for them than India. He thinks India is very important in the insurance market or whatever. So the steps the companies are doing, and Procter & Gamble, they always have one meeting a year outside the U.S. and they work with it. It's a tough thing to set it up. But every board member gets to spend half a day or a day seeing how their products are used in the village, in the territory, to try to really educate their boards on the specifics of their business. The question here.
Yeah, my question was, did this semiconductor, did they believe that they needed, was there any foresight and thought that we need to build a bigger brand in China? That's why, to me, I always think about these things in terms of what are people trying to accomplish? And, you know, if you are very chauvinistic and you really don't care about other markets and you're a U.S. company, then you're probably not available for that conversation if you don't see the benefit. The flip side is if you end up for some reason it's in happenstance to build a market in a foreign country, it just would seem to make sense to add. But someone with true foresight who would say, this is a great place for our product or what we're trying to do, and then goes out and finds somebody there, that just seems basic sales.
Yes.
As shareholders become more activist in nature as well as beneficial owners, I think you find that they're actually
you know, looking a little deeper when they're voting in elections? Are you finding that shareholder groups are putting forth reports more than they ever did before?
I haven't seen myself activist investors with respect to non-Americans on the board. Where I've seen it, where I've experienced it, and as a Panera Bread, we had an activist investor, Shamrock, the big Roy Disney. And they bought about 6% of our stock, and they met many times with management. They met with us as the board, and they had three or four objectives. They wanted us to have a larger board. They want us to have more people on the board with retail experience. They wanted to declassify the board so everyone gets elected every year. Suppose that we have 3-year terms, and our co-founder has Class A stock. He has more stock votes than the others, and they wanted to change that. And that was the pressure that we had. And of course, they threatened to put all this on the proxy, and let's have the shareholders vote on it. So we hired Goldman Sachs at an outrageous price to advise us. We had a public relations firm. We hired a law firm. And we spent a lot of money on this thing. And we had a lot of meetings with them, and we made a few changes. They took credit for all the changes. And then our stock price went up, and they sold their stock, and it was all over. But it was a very costly, expensive exercise. So I certainly, the proxy services who look at all these governance things, independence and stuff like that, and I haven't, certainly, more, because, you know, this year the proxies, you have to put on it why this person deserves to stay a director, what expertise, what experience they have. So I think, you know, more and more we're going in that direction. But I've never seen it myself for we want you to have a non-American on the board, but maybe that's coming. I don't know. Final question?
Let's take one more question.
Yeah, it's 6 o'clock already. I thought...
Yeah, yeah. Quick question. Is the momentum down the future? Do you see the emerging markets will look for more board that are non-native because of the experience of transparency that in many of the emerging markets have less degree of experience? Do you see any trend like China, Indonesia, India, where they have firms now needing to be more transparent and have more global interest, that they will start recruiting more?
So you mean the Wipros and the...
Huawei,
yeah. Well,
Tata may already be pretty...
And I think, you know, they have the same problem if they're committed to it. How do you find the right American who can fly to India that many times per year? And some of these meetings, you can do conference calls, you can do some videos, but you really have to do it. It's hard to find. I would expect that will continue. I mean, there are a few Chinese companies that I know have asked Americans to join them. I have a list, like I saw the other day, the 6 Chinese that are presently on the American company boards. So I think this is all going to happen. The other part of your question is, I think given the importance of the emerging markets, it always seems to me that why aren't the companies who are looking, you know, into the future, why aren't they coming to the best business schools and giving summer jobs to the best students from India, China, whatever, establish those relationships? I mean, I have this year teaching in the first year of the MBA program, my first year section of 54 students. I had 8 from India, all really, really smart. One day I was talking to the admissions director, and I said, you know, these students, these are really, and they're from Wipro and Accenture and IBM. They've all, you know, 2 or 3 years of work experience. And he said, well, yeah, this year we had 320 applications from India. I only accepted 25. So I didn't want to fill the class with Indians. So the ones we're getting, and, well, you know, in the past from Japan, whatever, but some of these students, now there are issues with visas and all that, they have trouble finding summer jobs. I had a terrific student last year from India who just couldn't get a good summer job. And Microsoft finally hired him, but then they couldn't get him into China. He speaks Chinese. He's from India. They couldn't get there because the Americans weren't like them, whatever. So, but yeah, if you take the right view, I think that's, I mean, you ought to get globalization not only at the top, but throughout the organization. Final question, yeah.
Just a comment, actually. Didn't think of it until you just mentioned it, but Brown's new executive MBA program is being established not just in the United States, but in Spain as well.
It's interesting. I didn't even think of it as being...
There's a lot of partnerships with executive MBAs between schools in Hong Kong and in Europe. A lot of these things. Well, I've enjoyed being with you. I'll be around for a while, and thank you very much.
I'm a friend of Pat Gray's, your former GC.
Yes, yes, yes. I saw it at dinner.
That's how I met Ron Shaikh.
Oh, okay. I saw her at an NICC dinner.
Oh, okay.
About 2 weeks ago.
Oh, you've seen her since more quickly than I.
But I was up today. I knew she went to Children's Place.
She went to,
but I know she's up here at American Science and Engineering now.
Well, she had a little child, and I hired her. And I helped her with that job.
It's me and my brother. My mother was resistant to air conditioning. So we told her to get it. We also told her to get a Tempur-Pedic mattress. We paid for that. But we got it. Pat is a great person. I'm glad that she's back in here. I knew American Science Engineering. Ralph was the president. Ralph Sherry.
Okay. I know the name.
He left. Lee Steele was there. Was the CFO. Mm-hmm. So that was like the prior generation. But I was glad to know that she's back.
I asked her about being there at PC when she left, because I was looking at the time I went there, something else. Anyway, I just wanted to mention.
Oh, okay. Well, that's
a good person.
Okay. Okay. Very profound question.
Yeah.
Well, thank you.
I call this enough for Derek myself. I was distracted. I was not quite on American Director. It's amazing how people who are otherwise remarkably well-rounded executives or professionals in my kind of world
And actually, if we go through these statistics that I gave you, a lot of the non-American directors of U.S. companies are from
it's not all that much.
And it's a big company.
Yeah, and it's
sensitive.
I think it's kind of random.
Now, I'm wondering
it occurred to me that this... Why do you think that
corporate advisors are not that
small?
Just
great job.
Oh, thank you.
I think I will see Ron in about 3 weeks or so.
Oh.
So I will...
I got an email from him today.
I got an email.
Anyway, nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Very interesting. I read an article about Ron actually today, and that's the whole premise. I thought it was pretty interesting.
Thank you.
And I guess that was interesting. 3 years ago, they went to a routine. You now have to go to a foreign country. Either the summer before or between the summer year, it's mandatory that you take one of the trip overseas on the money themselves up there. Wharton, I know my son's there. Wharton, it's not mandatory. It's like really, really, really strongly suggested. But the Stanford thing is it's mandatory. So you had to pick a foreign country. I guess you can go to Canada. Most of them did. They started, I think, easily 3 or 4 years ago, which would say your part about the international last year. Because he was talking about the difference on what that had done in the discussions and such in classes and invites, which you're sort of bubbling up as. So if that's any use for you, when you do this again.
Some schools, the minimum number of literacy is a requirement.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of it's strongly encouraged. And the other thing, what happens now, some students say, well, you know, I spent my junior year in college living in France.
Right.
I had to experience it. Or, you know, figure out the cost of how to do it, but there's some internships. This is part of the process. But what we do, but we have opportunities for students to go on these 2-week trips.
Mm-hmm.
We have one to India,
okay.
Europe, to Asia, actually, I don't know.
Okay.
I was coming out of training.
Yeah, so you get something, but it's not the same as the general terms.
Oh, yeah.
Some of the schools have partnerships with other schools.
Yeah, I don't think they had the term. I can't remember. You know, they talked about that, but it's interesting. You know, from you think you should take the 2 week trip to, you will.
Yeah.
And you need to put in that much more money. I guess they changed 4 years ago. When they talked about that was.
It's because, everyone says, it's travel. Mm-hmm. I mean, right now, I see it's trying to, they call it something called the gap year, part of the bridge year. So I'm trying to take the students who they've accepted to be freshmen.
Yeah.
And they're saying to them, money delayed by a year. We have this Princeton program in Africa coming there. And what they're a little upset about, it's a great concept. People say, but only 15% of students every year sign up for it. It doesn't go. Not getting as many students. They want to have that experience.
But 60 or 70 grand a year, or whatever it is, an extra year or the time.
No, your parents, it's not, not a Princeton, it's not Princeton. First of all, the family makes $60,000, and the person
is
free. And they make $8,000, pay 10%, $18,000. So there's no to attract.
I didn't know the government stuff. I was thinking, yeah, because I mean, the thing about it is, if you don't do those, you know, every school around now, I don't know if you've got to be much, it's quote 50, and then if you want to eat, throw another 20 grand in or something.
But actually, to go check, it's a very small percentage of people paying this.
Yeah.
Okay, good.
We'll enjoy it.
All right. Well, I'm sorry I can't come to your session.
Oh, okay.
Well, I guess I can get it. It'll be on the web.
Hey, thanks for including me.
Thank you.
I remember
Relation, human resources, and now sometimes human capital, chief people officer.
Well,
good.
Oh, well, great. I enjoyed it. Thank you.
Okay. So, thanks for coming up.
Do you know they'd be on their knees to you? But just because you pass that, besides that, that's practice.
Yeah,
that's
true.
So,
fascinating.
Definitely.
Okay? All right. Thank you.
I'm going to get to run a hospital.
So we don't have mine, but I'll email you.
We blew it. We blew it.
Thank you.